You're listening to live courtroom coverage of the trial of Karen Reed from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
You are unmuted.
Now open and maybe see.
All right, so I received a couple of motions a little while ago. Good morning, everybody, I'm sorry. And there are some things we need to talk about from yesterday. Are the jurors here? Okay, good. All right, so the order I'd like to do is, Mr. Jackson, yesterday you were going to take a look at any photographs you intend to put in with Dr. Lapisada.
Yes,
those
have been presented to the
committee. All right. Can I just, are you all in agreement or are you just looking at them now, Mr. Brennan?
I heard specifically from Mr. Brennan, but the issues that he had, obviously we're not at this juncture until we're referring, we're not going to bring in anything having to do with dog bites, claws, dog dentition, any of that information, but we are going to bring in exactly what we indicated yesterday. If there's an issue with, for instance, the ecchymosis, we've got a clean copy of the photograph without any of the narrative next to it, which is explanatory. The only one I think that does have narrative is the one with the Lucas machine, which Mr. Brennan indicated yesterday he did not have.
All right. So I need to know just for instructions to the jury about, I'm concerned about the photograph on page 5, figure 3.
The brainstem?
Yes.
Now that's going to be, we intend to show that. That shows the...
So what I would like you to do, if you could, is just crop the center that shows what appears to be blood cells or the red. I assume that that's the part you want to get into? Sure. If you can crop that, I'll let it in, and I still want to give an instruction. So I need to know what you're going to do with that. I was going to exclude it, but I understand. So if you can crop... Yes. Yes, if you can do that, I think it takes away some of the sting on the gruesome photographs. All right, so you'll do just the brainstem on that, Mr.
Yes,
Jackson?
Sir.
All right. And so I'm concerned more about the ones that I think may cause the jurors some concern. So the photograph, figure 5, the Wisniewski spots, I thought that was in evidence. I don't know for sure if it's in evidence.
We went back and forth yesterday, and I don't believe that it's actually in evidence. It is not.
Okay, so
it's not in evidence. That was
okay.
Yesterday, we all assumed it was.
Yes.
I'll put it in evidence
All right. They've already seen it, so it's
correct.
less likely to have an impact on them for purposes of the gruesome photographs. And then on page 8, figure 6, the stomach lining.
Correct, that's already in evidence.
Okay, that's what I thought, Tori, you told me yesterday the number, right? So those are in. So are you using them again?
I'm going to use them again comparatively and probably side by side.
Okay. All right, I don't have a problem with that. Does the Commonwealth?
I don't.
Okay. All right. Those are the ones I was concerned about for purposes of an instruction. If there's objections to hearsay or something, I'll give Mr. Brennan an opportunity to take a look at whatever he's got.
Understood.
Okay. All right. So with that, that's helpful. Thank you. So there is a new motion this morning suggesting that the Commonwealth open the door with their questioning of Dr. Russell to allow Dr. Lapisada to talk about bite wounds. So I've read that.
Correct. I'd like to hear all that briefly.
Okay, sure.
Thank you. I'd like to start, if I may, by marking two documents with your permission. One is Dr. Lapisada's entire report, and the second is
her
entire CV.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, those are the ones I needed from yesterday. So, yes.
witness name and his ID?
Yes.
Exhibits DDDD and exhibits EEEE.
Okay. All right, go ahead, Mr. Jackson.
Thank you, Your Honor. We are asking the court to reconsider the court's ruling yesterday concerning Dr. La Posada and her ability to opine on the issue of dog bites, dog bite and claw mark wounds and pattern recognition. We had some concerns yesterday and previous to yesterday about an issue that has been ongoing with the Commonwealth, and we've brought this to the court's attention. The Commonwealth has been using a tactic to shift the burden to the defense with cross-examination that's laced with indications or implications about witnesses that may or may not be called by the defense. That is a problem. I brought it to the court's attention at sidebar. The court will probably remember that colloquy. It was not an open court, but I expressed grave concerns, to use that phrase, that there was a burden-shifting system that was going on when Mr. Brennan is asking our witnesses about, or his witnesses, about other witnesses that may be on the defense witness list and may be called. Obviously, as the court knows, foundationally, we don't have to call anybody. We don't intend to call anybody, we don't have to call anybody, but we can call whoever we feel like. But we shouldn't be put in a position where our hand is forced to call witnesses because of questioning by the Commonwealth, which is improper. After I brought it to the court's attention, Mr. Brennan has continued along that same line. The Commonwealth has continued along that same line, and I want to bring something to the court's attention specifically. Last night, we pulled the tape. Dr. Russell was cross-examined by Mr. Brennan on the issue specifically of Dr. La Posada and her opinions regarding dog bites. He asked questions over and over and over again. The colloquy probably lasted more than 5, 6, 7 minutes with Dr. Russell specifically on the issue of whether or not she had seen Dr. La Posada's reports, whether she was aware of Dr. La Posada's opinions, implying that Dr. La Posada had opinions about the dog bites. She was asked if she was familiar with Dr. La Posada's credentials. Dr. Russell said, yes, she was familiar with Dr. La Posada by name, that she thought she had impeccable credentials, and she very much wished she could have seen her reports as it relates to dog bites. It was an intellectual curiosity by Dr. Russell that was evoked and elicited by Mr. Brennan on cross-examination of Dr. Russell. She was then asked the seminal question, did the defense, Dr. Russell, give you any reports by Dr. La Posada related to dog bites?
What page is that on here?
On the transcript?
Yes.
My motion's back at the desk.
Oh, I see it.
Does the court have it?
Yes.
Okay. I'll just read it. Question by Mr. Brennan to Dr. Russell. And so you think of all those forensic pathologists, medical examiners, you think that qualification and experience itself is not enough to qualify someone to give an opinion on a photograph about the genesis of a wound related to dog bites? Answer, well, if a forensic pathologist autopsied one or two cases of dog bite wounds versus my experience with over 500 to 1,000 cases of dog bite wounds, I'm not sure that person would be a very good expert in that kind of case. Question by Mr. Brennan. Have you ever heard of a doctor named La Posada?
So are you going to read all three pages?
No.
So I've read it, Mr. Jackson.
I'd like to read it into the record, Your Honor.
It's in the record. I will put this transcript into the record. I'm not going to let you read three pages here.
It's not three pages, Your Honor. It's about another five lines. It just goes to the top of the next page.
My attention is on page 15, not where you're reading.
Colloquy between Dr. Lopez, I'm sorry, between Dr. Russell and Mr. Brennan was specific to dog bite wounds. It was specific to Dr. Russell's understanding of whether or not Dr. La Posada had been retained by the defense, whether she was a defense expert, whether she had written a report, and whether she opined about dog bites and dog bite wounds. And after she was asked if she was had been provided any reports by the defense, by the defense attorneys specifically, from Dr. La Posada related to dog bite wounds, Dr. Russell said, no, I haven't been. And to summarize her statements, which the court has in front of it, Dr. Russell went on and said, I really wanted to see what Dr. La Posada had to say about these dog bite wounds. I really wanted to read her report. But no, I was never provided her report or reports by the defense. And of course, Your Honor, as the court knows, that is standard operating procedure. I don't trade reports between and among experts because obviously I want independent analysis. I don't want to cross-contaminate any opinions, et cetera, and be accused of doing so. So of course we didn't provide a report from Dr. La Posada to Dr. Russell. But Dr. Russell's intellectual curiosity was then extracted from the witness stand and the jurors heard all of that. So then days later, not weeks, not months, 3 days later, after eliciting testimony from Dr. Russell about Dr. La Posada having a report, being hired by the defense on the issue of dog bites and not providing that report to Dr. Russell, the Commonwealth then moves to exclude the very testimony that he was eliciting from Dr. Russell, leaving the jurors with a very, very deep and irremediable misimpression. They used it tactically as a sword and a shield, and that's burden shifting. That leaves the jury with the impression that Dr. La Posada was consulted by the defense, number one, that she wrote a report, number two, that the report was about dog bites, number three, that she didn't provide that report to other experts, number four, and the reason she didn't, obviously, is because her opinion, Dr. La Posada's opinion, would be harmful to the defense. That's the only reasonable interpretation of those facts. And the Commonwealth has taken advantage of that. The Commonwealth's questioning of Dr. Russell about Dr. La Posada and her report and her opinions about dog bite wounds specifically was deliberate, and it left the jury with an open question. We know they consulted her. We know it was about dog bites. This is how the jurors are thinking about it now. We know they consulted her. We know it was about dog bites. They hid the report from Dr. Russell because they didn't want her to know about it. Ergo, must be harmful to defense. Now we've got Dr. La Posada on the stand. Her credentials are peerless, absolutely peerless. They've got possibly the most qualified medical examiner in the country, certainly on the Eastern Seaboard, right in front of them, about 6 feet away, and the defense is not going to ask a single question about her opinions concerning dog bites when she reviewed the entire autopsy. How is the jury going to conceive that? How is that going to land with them? The answer is they're going to think, they have no choice but to think, the only reasonable explanation is if Dr. La Posada's opinion helped the defense, they would ask her. If they don't ask her, it's because whatever Dr. La Posada says about that right arm and those wounds, it's got to be harmful to the defense. They would absolutely ask the question. So the Commonwealth got to have it both ways. They got to ask Dr. Russell about Dr. La Posada and imply that Dr. La Posada had opinions about dog bite wounds, and then they have it the other way, which is, let's ask the court if she will exclude Dr. La Posada from testifying about the very issue that they brought up in front of Dr. Russell. That cannot stand. It reasonably ensures that the jury will misrepresent or misunderstand the import of why we're not asking Dr. La Posada about her expert opinion, especially as it specifically pertains to dog bite wounds. I want to talk for just a second, and that has, by the way, that has constitutional implications. Ms. Reed is entitled to a fair trial, not a fair trial that the Commonwealth designs, not a fair trial that the Commonwealth curates, but a fair trial. Regarding Dr. La Posada's credentials, we went back through, specific to the court's questions yesterday, her resume. There are no fewer than 13 classes, 13, that she has taught specific to wound pattern recognition that have included dog bite recognition. On page 7, she was the course director for medical legal death investigation. That was in 2013. That she taught about dog bite recognition in that case, or in that course. She was a thesis advisor for Master of Science Graduate Medical School, Boston University School of Medicine, taught about dog bites. Staying with page 7, forensic pathology, course director in pathology, course 205, taught about dog bites. Member of Quality Assurance Committee, Training Division of Trauma and Surgical Critical Care, teaching on the issue of wound recognition, animal bites, and specific to dog bites. Pediatric Forensic Pathology, Texas Homicide Symposium. She was a presenter in 1989. She taught about the issue of dog bites as it relates to pediatrics, children, dog bites in children. Forensic aspects of physical child abuse as related to being left with dogs that can injure a child, dog bites, dog bite recognition. These are all classes taught by Dr. La Posada on the issue of dog bites to other medical professionals. The one that stands out, however, and I'm not going to go through the other 9 or 10 or 11, the one that stands out is 2015 and 2016, two courses. The name of the course, Emergency Room Forensics, Evidence and Patterned Injuries, New England Chapter of the International Association of Forensic Nurses, taught in Norwood, Massachusetts, both times, specific to dog bites and the issue of dog bites as seen by emergency room physicians, how they should handle them, what they should do with them, how they should view them, what to look for in terms of pattern recognition. She's eminently qualified. I will leave the court with one thought. The court indicated when qualifying Dr. Russell, one of the preeminent things that the court mentioned in qualifying Dr. Russell is that Dr. Russell utilized a methodology that the court sanctioned and quoted and said the methodology that she used of wound pattern recognition, dealing with differential diagnosis, utilizing and interpreting dog bites by the method of exactly what Dr. Russell did. Differential diagnosis is something that the court said was exactly why the court sanctioned Dr. Russell and blessed Dr. Russell as a qualified expert, and that's exactly what Dr. La Posada testified yesterday she utilized and utilizes in coming to her opinions and conclusions. Going back to the open door issue, obviously she's eminently qualified, but Your Honor, this cannot stand. The Commonwealth cannot have it both ways. They cannot walk up and say and leave the impression with the jurors that Dr. La Posada opined about the dog wounds, but we're not able to hear it. We, the jurors, are not able to hear it because obviously that is something that is her opinion, whatever it might be, is harmful to the defense. When in truth and in fact, it's exactly the opposite. Dr. La Posada's opinion has never wavered. Those injuries on John O'Keefe's arm are from a dog, period, full stop. Anything less than presenting that to the jury at this point would be to perpetrate an intentional fraud on this jury. Ms. Reed is entitled to more, she's entitled to better, she's entitled to the evidence.
All right, thank you, Mr. Brennan.
The pattern of conduct that stands out is persistent, repetitive, contrary to court rulings and court orders, and deliberate. And that is the defense uses their witnesses to vouch for their own credibility. They use their witnesses to introduce information they know is not admissible, and they use their witnesses to introduce otherwise inadmissible hearsay. Dr. Russell took the stand and she was led into answers where she was vouching for her own credibility. Dr. Russell promoted herself not only as an expert, but through the defense's questions, as virtually the only expert in America who has the expertise to give this type of opinion. It is the defendant's tactics that open these doors that they then want closed. The defense had Dr. Russell all but assure the jury that she uniquely was in the position to give any type of opinion regarding dog bites. Inevitably, when I asked Dr. Russell, and I began asking her about her credentials, whether she thought that she was exclusive, and I mentioned Dr. La Posada, she denied ever reading anything about Dr. La Posada. I did not specify whether she read an opinion about a dog bite. I asked if she had heard about Dr. La Posada. She denied it. And then she told us that she knew about Dr. Sheridan. Unsolicited, then added that Dr. Sheridan, involved in a previous proceeding, believed that the bites were consistent with dog bites. I don't know how she became aware of Dr. Sheridan's testimony, and since the defense doesn't speak to her about these things, she must have watched it on her own. But inevitably, she introduced inadmissible hearsay and inadmissible opinions. And so the sum zero here is that Dr. Russell has denied that she saw anything relative to Dr. La Posada, ensured that she was exclusively qualified, and introduced an improper opinion of Dr. Sheridan. Dr. La Posada was voir dired briefly. She did not provide qualifications that she has a history of education or training on patent wound recognition analysis as it pertains to dog bites. We asked her questions about her specific experience. She did not provide a basis, and so her opinions regarding dog bites should not be permitted in this trial.
Just to clear up the record, two things stand out about
that speech. Mr. Brennan literally just said, I didn't elicit any information about dog bites. I just asked about her experience. Question by Mr. Brennan.
That's not what I said. That is
excuse
not
me.
What I, that, no, I'm not going to.
So, I heard what Mr. Brennan said. You don't need to tell me what Mr. Brennan said, but go ahead to
how
your argument.
How about if I quote his words? How about that? Question. And so you think of all those forensic pathologists, medical examiners, and you think qualification and experience itself is not enough to qualify somebody to give an opinion on a photograph about the genesis of a wound related to dog bites. The question was specific to dog bites. That's how he introduced the subject matter to Dr. Russell. Then his next question was, have you ever heard of a doctor named Dr. La Posada? Those were his words. Then he goes on, I think he also just said that he did not elicit information about other individuals, including Dr. Sheridan or anybody else. Question by Mr. Brennan, were you ever told what other people's opinions might be regarding those photographs? That's the question that she was answering when she said, quote, I'm aware that there was a Dr. Sheridan involved in a previous proceeding, and he believed that those were consistent with dog bites. That was in relation or in response to Mr. Brennan's specific question. She didn't just elicit that. She didn't volunteer it. She said it because he asked her. And that was all by design. The entire thing has been by design. He elicited the information suggesting that Dr. La Posada was being hidden from Dr. Russell because her opinion would harm the defense. He left that with her on purpose, then turned around and 3 days later said, and by the way, the defense should be disallowed from using Dr. La Posada to talk about the very dog bite wounds that I asked Dr. Russell about. That cannot stand as a scorecard.
Go ahead.
It's helpful if you read the entire thing in context, which I won't do. We always have a right to object to an inadmissible opinion. So the suggestion that somehow an ambush here is not only misplaced, it's strategic by the defense to try to create an error. It's improper.
All right. I'll be out in 10 minutes on this, and we'll get started right away with Dr. Lepisada.
All right, the court, please.
All right. So I'm not going to allow Dr. La Posada to testify regarding dog bites. Your rights are saved. I'm going to give an instruction regarding burden shifting. So.
I just think it's outrageous. I think the conduct is outrageous. And I don't think that the appearance instruction can do anything except bring the point home again.
Okay.
But if the court is not willing to allow her to testify to her full opinion to a reason he's being assigned to service, can she at least testify that she reviewed the arm, looked at the arm, and it's consistent with an animal? Can we at least split the baby?
I will do that. I will allow that, yes. Over the Commonwealth's objection.
And I look to have the cross-examiner on it, because if you want to allow a consistent opinion with a dog...
No, Mr. Jackson said animal.
I'll leave it at animal if that's what I can get. I'll take what I can get.
In her experience, Mr. Jackson, you have to lay a foundation. In her experience, seeing animal bites, this is consistent with what she has seen in an animal bite.
And that will include... I'll come to sidebar before I display anything. That will include a representation of what an animal jaw looks like.
No. No, it will not.
Why is that?
That's my ruling, Mr. Jackson.
So no visuals?
No visuals. Just that one sentence that's consistent with what she has seen is an animal bite. A brief foundation, because I'm letting that statement in. As long as she testifies that she has seen animal bites over the years. That's it, Mr. Brennan. That's what I'm doing. So you don't want an instruction, Mr. Jackson? Okay. All right. So there are two other quick matters, but the jury's been here, and I don't think we'll get past the break without this anyway. I may have left it in the... I left it in my office anyway. So let's just bring the jurors in and move forward with this. All right, Paul, I'm just going to take two.
All right, please.
You are unmuted.
Yes, thank you. Surprise
for the jury. All persons have any business before the Honorable Beverly Canoni, Justice of the Norfolk Superior Court, and for the country of Norfolk. Draw near, give your attendance, and you shall be heard. God save the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. This court is now open. You may be seated.
Good morning, jurors. Thank you for your patience this morning. I know we brought you in late. Maybe should have brought you in a little bit later, but we've been working in an effort to sort of streamline things for you. So I do have those questions I have to ask you. Is everyone able to follow my instructions and refrain from discussing this case with anyone since we left yesterday?
Yes.
Everyone said yes or nodded affirmatively. Were you also able to follow the instructions and refrain from doing any independent research or investigation into this case?
Yes.
Everyone said yes or nodded affirmatively. Did anyone happen to see, hear, or read anything about this case since we left yesterday?
No.
Everyone said no. All right, can we have Dr. Lapisada back, please?
And Doctor, I'll remind you, you're still under oath. Thank you.
Thank you. I will.
Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Jackson, go right ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Dr. Lapisada. Nice to see you again.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Yesterday, when we last left off, we were talking about a small injury to the upper eyelid of Mr. O'Keefe. Do you recall that?
I do.
Could we have Exhibit 165 with the court's permission, please?
Okay.
I'd like you to take a look at a specific area. I could. There we go. Right here on this exhibit. Do you see that area?
Yes, I do.
Is that, tell us what that is.
And that is a horizontal splitting of the skin, which was caused by application of force that overcame the tissue's resistance, so the tissue split. And behind that, we see the raccoon eye discoloration of the eyelid from the basal or skull fractures.
Can we have Exhibit 13, please? I want to draw your attention to this area of the vehicle. First of all, do you recognize this photograph?
Yes, I do.
How do you recognize that photograph?
I recognize it from looking at it in my materials reviewed, that it's the rear of Ms. Reed's SUV.
Taking a look at the area that I'm highlighting, right about there.
Yes.
Could we zoom in on that area? Do you see that overhang over the window?
Yes, I do.
If I use the word spoiler, would you understand what I'm talking about?
Yes, yes, I do.
Is the laceration to Mr. O'Keefe's upper eyelid that we just looked at, is that consistent, in your opinion, with a strike from that area of the vehicle if that vehicle were traveling in reverse at, say, 20-plus miles per hour?
No, that rounded, thick area would not cause that skin defect in his upper eyelid.
If in fact a person were hit at say 20 plus miles an hour in the face with that rounded edge, what kind of injury would you expect to see on that person's face?
I would expect to see a ribbon of bruise that would correspond to the height of that spoiler. And then it would go across the eyeball, it would hit the nose. So I would expect to see some horizontal ribbon of bruise.
Did you see anything consistent with that, with Mr. O'Keefe's injuries?
No, nothing.
Thank you. We can take that down. We talked yesterday about this phenomenon known as coup contra coup injury to the brain, correct?
Yes.
What happens to the brain after a coup contra coup, a significant coup contra coup injury?
Yes, this was quite a severe brain injury. Was injured on the back of the brain and also the front of the brain. The falling back and impacting the back of the head made the skull fracture radiate along the base of the brain on the right and left sides. It also radiated around on the side of the skull, and that indicates a tremendous transfer of force and energy to the skull and then to the brain. And the brain is rattled around, therefore, within the cerebral spinal fluid in the skull. So what that does is that it breaks the connections between the neurons in the brain and causes small little hemorrhages, and it causes the brain to swell. So when you get an injury, like if you get an injury on your arm, starts to swell. The same thing happens when that injury energy is applied to the brain. The brain starts to swell. And unfortunately, the brain, when it swells, it doesn't have anywhere to go because it's encased in the skull. So what happens is that the brain start and the brain stem under the brain starts to go down the opening in the base of the skull where your spinal cord goes. And that is a harbinger of death. because that means that the brain stem is getting pushed down in this hole in the skull and compressing the areas in the brain stem which control the heartbeat and breathing. And that's called brain stem herniation. And that you just die after that. So that's what happened to Mr. O'Keefe's brain.
Your Honor, I have a document that I'd like to approach with.
Okay. Yes.
Doctor, can you take a look at that document that I've just handed you and tell me if you recognize it?
Yes, I recognize this.
How do you recognize that document?
From looking at the autopsy photos of Mr. O'Keefe's brain.
And what portion of the brain are you looking at?
This shows a photograph looking up under the brain, and it shows a cross section of the brain stem that went down in the hole in the base of the skull, and we see there's hemorrhage in it. And those have a special name. They're called Duray hemorrhages.
How do you spell that?
D-U-R-E-T with a little, there's a little accent somewhere there.
Carrot over the E?
Yes. Okay. And this shows that the brainstem is going down into the hole where the spinal cord goes. It's stretching the blood vessels and causes little hemorrhage and compresses the neurons in the brainstem, which control your heart rate and your respiration. It's called brainstem herniation, and that's a harbinger of immediate death.
Your Honor, with that, I would ask for the admission of the next, that document is next in order, subject to the appropriate actions.
Okay. So we'll take that into evidence. Yes.
Your Honor, with the court's permission, with the redaction, may I present the...
Not yet. 1 minute. Jurors, I told you before that there were photographs that have been introduced into evidence that aren't pleasant. And you may find that these photographs are graphic. And I'm instructing you again that your verdict must not in any way be influenced by the fact that these photographs, you'll see some more today, I believe, that have already been introduced into evidence. So your verdict must not in any way be influenced by the fact that these photographs may be unpleasant or graphic. The defendant's entitled to a verdict based solely on the evidence and not one based on pity or sympathy for the deceased, which might be occasioned by the photographs. Importantly, consider the photographs only as they may draw your attention to a clinical medical status or to the nature of Mr. O'Keefe's injuries themselves. So again, these will be presented to you in the deliberation room in an envelope. But today you'll see some on the screen, and I just wanted you to know that before you see it. So now you can display it.
Your Honor, may I approach very briefly?
Yes.
If you wouldn't mind taking a look at that document,
Is
that a redacted version or a close-up version of just the brainstem?
Yes, this photograph shows the cross-section going this way of the brainstem with the hemorrhages caused by the brainstem going down into the foramen magnum.
With that, Your Honor, actually, with the court's permission, I would trade that as the next in order rather than the unredacted version.
All right, is there any objection to the switching the exhibits like that?
I don't.
Okay.
Thank you.
Oh, and the arrows point to that on there.
So this is going to be the next exhibit?
That'll be it.
Exhibit 225, Mark.
Thank you. The other one will be ID for identification, first one.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And that'll be FFF for ID.
Thank you.
Okay, you can display it now.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Wolt. Do you see what's displayed on the screen above your head?
Yes.
What is that?
Excuse me, that's a cross-section across the brainstem of Mr. O'Keefe, and it shows where the blue arrows I've put in there show the red areas, which are areas of bleeding, which is the sign of brainstem herniation. All the background is white material, and that's part of the appearance of neurons in the brain. So that shows that the brainstem, because of the brain swelling, pushed it down into the hole in the base of the skull where the spinal cord goes, and it pulls on the blood vessels, causing the blood vessels to break and the blood vessels to bleed. And that shows you that the brain stem has been compressed and damaged, causing death.
May I approach?
Yes.
I'm holding a green laser pointer.
Oh, thank you.
You can use the display to your right. So the viewers can better see it, could you point to the areas with that laser pointer of the bleeding that you indicated causes the swelling?
Okay, so, okay. Is that going on the...
It is. It's probably hard for you to see.
Oh, that's okay. So this sort of roundish thing is the brainstem, and the arrows are pointing to the red areas. So there's a blood vessel that's broken there because it's been... torn and pulled with surrounding blood going into the neuronal tissue here and over here and over here. And also some of this is also bleeding with the blood being looking brown because the brain was placed in formaldehyde. So all this brown area, the red area, should not be there.
Is this type of herniation life-threatening?
It causes death. Yes, it is life-threatening.
How quickly, we can take that down. How quickly, doctor, would you expect that this could cause, let's first talk about incapacitation.
Yes.
How quickly would someone be incapacitated after they suffer a coup contra coup injury of this magnitude with mm-hmm. the concomitant injuries that you mm-hmm. see in the brainstem?
Well, there would be two parts to what that injury would cause the body to do. First, there would be immediate unconsciousness because of the transfer of all the energy to the brain and the massive skull fractures. So that, excuse me, so that would disrupt the normal function of the brain and produce immediate unconsciousness. Then the brain would start to swell. And within 15, 20 minutes or so, then that brainstem starts to go down the opening in the bottom of the skull, and then the blood vessels are broken, the brainstem gets compressed, and the centers in that brainstem, which control the heart and the respiration, then stop. So you go unconscious, brain swells, then you die.
Turning to the actual, your review of the actual brain, in this instance, Mr. O'Keefe's injuries specifically, did you reach any conclusion or opinion to a reasonable degree of medical certainty about his incapacitation, the length of time it would take for him to become first incapacitated and ultimately to be rendered dead?
He would be immediately incapacitated with a decreased level of consciousness. Once he received that impact on the back of the head, he would not be able to make any purposeful movements. There might be some arm jerking or some seizure activity, but he would not be able to carry. He wouldn't be able to get up. He wouldn't be able to walk. He wouldn't be able to do any purposeful activity. He would be severely concussed, unconscious, not able to walk, not able to carry out purposeful activity. And then as the brain continues swelling and that brain stem gets compressed, then the heartbeat is disrupted, the breathing is disrupted, and then those heart and breathing stop. And within 15 or 20 minutes, then he could be dead.
Is that opinion to a reasonable degree of medical certainty?
Yes, it is.
You testified concerning wound pattern recognition pretty extensively during the course of your giving your qualifications. What is a patterned injury?
A patterned injury is very basic to the training in forensic pathology and medicine because it helps us understand some change on the body, some pattern injury that corresponds to the object that made it. So we can look at an injury and say, we can figure out what made that. Sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. But a pattern injury is very important for a forensic pathologist to recognize because it's going to really help the police investigation because I can say, oh, this looks like it's a wound from a scissors. This looks like it's a wound from a screwdriver stab. So by identifying the pattern that object makes on the body, I can help the death investigation by helping the police say, you know, look for some screwdriver, look for some hammer. So looking at that, identifying a pattern injury is really important to it's basic to the forensic pathologist's knowledge base, and then also very important to the investigation of the crime or incident.
I'd like you to look at another photograph, an exhibit that's already been put into evidence. 160, please, with the court's permission.
Yes, jurors, this may be one of the photographs as well. All right, or there'll be a series.
Dr. La Posada, I want to draw your attention to the center of this photograph.
Yes.
First of all, do you recognize what's depicted here?
Yes, I do.
How do you recognize?
I recognize it from reviewing the autopsy photographs of Mr. O'Keefe.
You reviewed it, informing your opinions and conclusions?
Yes.
Can you describe what's depicted in this photograph? What are we looking at?
Yes. So we're looking at the back of Mr. O'Keefe's head and an injury caused by the angular acceleration going down and hitting his head in the back. And then this is also a patterned injury. So what we see is the horizontal tear of the scalp, and we can see it's undermined a little bit. So that means the direction is going from bottom to top. Also, we see these sort of vertical lines in here and down below. So what that tells me is that the back of his head hit something that had a fine granular pattern to it to cause those individual little marks, and then also something that had a linear or ridged pattern that he went back on that broke the scalp there. So we have two parts really to this pattern injury. We have the horizontal tear of the scalp made by impact with some sort of ridged surface. And then we have these vertical scraping of the skin above and also below. They're obscured a little bit by the ruler there, which says that whatever he hit had some little like granularity to it with each little sort of granule making those vertical marks, and then the ridged pattern having the major point of impact.
What is the significance of the pattern when you say ridged pattern and there's two things we're looking at, the laceration or the abrasion versus the defect above and below that laceration?
Yeah, so what this injury tells me, what I would tell the investigators, is that Mr. O'Keefe went back onto some object that had some sort of ridge to it to make that horizontal tear in the skin, but that ridge also had, it wasn't smooth. It had some little grainy grainy things sticking up on it that would make each of them these little things. And then it's the job of the police then to go back to the scene and look around for something which might fit that pattern.
We can take that down. Did you, in furtherance of your investigation, coming to your opinions and conclusions, look at the area of 34 Fairview?
The outside, yes.
Meaning photographs?
Yes.
Did you also see photographs of any significance to you related to the garage, the interior of the garage?
Yes.
Sustained.
There it is.
Jurors, disregard that comment, that question.
What part of the area did you see? What part of the location did you see?
excuse me. I saw all the scene photographs taken by the police, which showed the front yard in the area where Mr. O'Keefe was found. I also saw some photographs of the inside of the house and the inside of...
So I'm going to stop you there, Dr. Lapisata. Yes. Jurors, I'm striking anything after what the pictures from outside, Mr. Jackson. Move on.
Let's stay with the outside of the home. Did
yes.
you see the front lawn area?
Yes, I did.
How did you, what did you note about the front lawn area?
Well, I was looking at the area where Mr. O'Keefe's body was found, because we know once he came back and slammed his head, he's not going to get up and move around.
So, yes, I'm going to strike the second part of that. Just answer the question specifically.
Okay, I'll try, Your Honor. Thank you.
Why were you interested in the outside area where his body was found?
Because then I could identify an object possibly there that would have caused the injury on the back of his head.
Did you see any such object in any of the photos that you reviewed?
No, there was nothing there. It was a flat grass surface.
Would the flat grass, let's assume that the grass was very cold and very hard, the dirt was very cold and very hard, would falling backward onto that dirt, hard or not, would that cause the patterned injury that you see that we just saw in Exhibit 160?
No.
Why do you say that?
Because if you fall back on a flat surface, you get many times the tear you get in the scalp can be more like a star, because you've just hit one part and then the tears go in kind of a star pattern. And also because you would not have those vertical, discrete vertical scraping of the skin. You would tend to, if you fell back on grass, you would tend to see, you might see grass in the wound, or you would tend to see an irregular kind of crisscross pattern of the flattened grass. And that's not what we have here on Mr. O'Keefe.
Do you have any training and experience in diagnosing hypothermia in individuals?
Oh, yes.
Have you conducted autopsies of individuals who have suffered from or died from hypothermia?
Yes, many.
How many?
Oh, 100 or more, and then I've supervised my assistants who've also diagnosed the same death from decrease in body temperature.
Have you ever engaged in any death investigation, aside from the actual autopsies, death investigations in which the cause of death was deemed to be hypothermia?
Yes.
How many times would you say you've undertaken that type of investigation?
At least 100.
Have you ever reviewed any peer-reviewed medical literature associated with or discussing hypothermia and something known as Wisniewski spots?
Yes, that's in the medical literature and also in our forensic textbooks.
Did you review the medical examiner's file, Dr. Scordibello's file, as it related to, in connection with this case, you reviewed the entire file, correct?
I did.
Did you conduct a differential diagnosis as it relates to the potential for hypothermia?
Yes, I did.
Describe, before we get into your findings or your conclusions and opinions, what is inferential thinking?
Inferential thinking is another name for making a differential diagnosis. In other words, seeing a finding and then saying, how many ways can I get that finding? And then go and investigate each one of those ways and either rule them in or rule them out as being responsible to causing that finding.
Did you note whether or not the medical examiner, Dr. Scordibello, mentioned hypothermia as a potential cause of death in this case?
She did put that on the death certificate.
Along with something else?
Along with the blunt force head injury.
Do you agree with or concur with the blunt force head injury
as a cause
of death?
Yes, Mr. O'Keefe died from the blunt force head injury.
Do you concur with the diagnosis of hypothermia?
No, the body did not have any hypothermia.
What led you to that conclusion?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's, when you have we know that normal body temperature is around 98, and we know that then at the hospital that Mr. O'Keefe's rectal temperature was around 80. So we know that his temperature went down. So there are two ways the body temperature can get down. It can get down while you're alive, or a dead body also cools when it's in a cold environment. So those are the two things you have to look at.
I'd like you to take a look. I'm
show
sorry,
Mr.
may I approach you?
Yep, show mm-hmm. Mr. Warrington.
Thank you, I apologize.
Yes.
Do you recognize what's depicted in that photograph?
Yes, I do.
What is that?
This is a photograph I took from our forensic medical literature, and it shows the lining of the stomach. So the stomach is opened up, and we look at the lining of the stomach, and it shows a characteristic pattern of small ulcerations throughout the stomach, which are called medically Wisniewski's ulcers, and that allows a forensic pathologist to diagnose death from being exposed to a cold environment or death due to hypothermia. And they're caused by, as the body gets colder and colder when it's alive, the small blood vessels in the lining of the stomach, they start to break, and then they're in the acidic environment of the stomach, and you get tiny little ulcers, which then look like small dots. And that is how at post-mortem examination or autopsy, it's one of the findings I look for to see if a person died from hypothermia.
Doctor, what is gastric mucosa as it relates to the stomach lining?
The gastric mucosa, when you open up the stomach and you look at the inside, the first cells lining that inside is called the mucosa.
Is that what we're looking at in this photograph or no?
Yes, we're looking at the mucosa with ulcerations, which are little craters that form in it due to hypothermia.
Is that exemplar of what Wisniewski spots looks like as it relates to hypothermia from a book that is, or literature that is peer-reviewed?
Oh, yes.
Is it widely accepted in the medical field?
Yes, it is.
And is it referenced by forensic pathologists and used in teaching?
Yes.
Your Honor, I would move for the admission of that photograph.
Okay.
$226.
Permission to display, Your Honor?
Yes.
Is this a fair representation of what you were just looking at?
Yes.
Describe what we're looking at.
Okay, so this, I took this photograph from our forensic medical literature, and this was from a person who died due to exposure to a cold environment. And this is the stomach has been opened, and we're looking at the inside of the stomach. And the normal appearance is kind of pinky white. That's how it should look like. And what's abnormal here is all these black dots, which are the Wisniewski's ulcers, which are diagnostic of death due to exposure to the cold. So these areas are a little tiny craters, and they fill up with blood. And we see that in over 90% of the cases of people who die from exposure to the cold.
Doctor, did you also look at Mr. O'Keefe's stomach lining?
Yes, I did.
If we could have, with the court's permission, Exhibit 164 put up as well.
Okay.
Do you see the photograph on the right?
Yes.
What is that of?
This is the Mr. O'Keefe's stomach, which has been opened up, and we're looking at the inside. We see that the mucosa is a little bit red, and there's a little bit of increased blood flow here, and this is the normal pattern of the inside of the stomach. It's kind of ridged, that's called rugae. That's the normal folds inside the stomach. But there's no ulcerations here. So the diagnosis of death due to hypothermia is not appropriate in his case.
Did you see or do you see any classic Wisniewski spots in Mr. O'Keefe's stomach lining or gastric mucosa?
No.
Do you observe any ulcers specific to Mr. O'Keefe's stomach lining?
No, there are no ulcers. It's a normal appearance of what we would call a gross specimen when you open the stomach. At autopsy, you can see some redness of the normal lining of the stomach.
Let me ask this first. Do you have an opinion as to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty based on the totality of your review and examination of the autopsy and its associated file, an opinion as to whether or not Mr. O'Keefe died of hypothermia or complications related to hypothermia?
I do have an opinion.
And what is that opinion?
He did not die of hypothermia.
And is that opinion to a reasonable degree of medical certainty?
Yes.
Taking a look at the darker red areas in the stomach lining of Mr. O'Keefe on the photograph to the right.
Yes.
That's exhibit 164. Can you describe what those are? What are those darker areas?
Here we see a little bit of bleeding. The darker areas are the areas of the lining that are at the bottom of the normal rugae. Because the inside surface of the stomach sort of looks like it's covered with little mountains. And so we can get the redness in between what the rugae in the stomach. And there's a little bit of increased redness here, but no ulceration.
Do you have an opinion, or were you able to form an opinion, as to what the increased redness might be or is associated with?
Yes.
Did you note anything of significance in the rest of your examination of the file, the autopsy file, the medical examiner's file, that was related to what you see in the photograph 164?
Yes.
All right, I'm going to see its eyebrow for just a minute here.
We can take that down. May I continue?
Yes.
Thank you. With regard to the, it's my word, not yours, doctor, so forgive me, the defects, the redder marks that you're mentioning on the rugae or in and around the rugae on the gastric mucosa, did you note that there was a machine that was used for life-saving measures as it related to Mr. O'Keefe?
Oh, yes, it caused some damage to the body.
Okay, let's talk about that for just a quick second. What is that machine called?
It's a mechanical device to administer chest compressions, and the company that makes it is called Lucas, or one of the companies, so it's called a Lucas machine, and it can be attached to the body. Your arms go up over a ridge, and there's a plunger, and it goes around your back, and so it just plunges, and it does mechanical resuscitation and chest compression, compressing the chest right over the lower sternum about 2 inches or so, and it's very helpful in a situation where the manual compressions, where the attendants and the ERT people, they get tired continually compressing for a long period of time. So the mechanical device was invented to prevent the EMT fatigue when administering chest compressions.
When you mention the sternum area,
yes,
of the body, are there organs beneath the area that's being compressed by the mechanical Lucas machine?
Oh, absolutely.
What do those organs include?
Well, ideally they include the heart, because that's what's supposed to be pumping the blood out, but it's also in a circular area that's right below the sternum, which includes the heart, but what is also under there is the esophagus and the interior of the stomach. So this area is right under where the machine is compressing as well, as long as in addition to part of the head of the pancreas, which is also right there under the lower sternum. And what can happen with the Lucas machine pushing in for 100 times a minute for a depth of about 2 or 2.5 inches, that these organs right underneath of it get compressed between the Lucas pump and the bony vertebral bodies that's along your back. So you have the Lucas machine compressing these organs, and they're compressing them against the vertebral bodies of your bony vertebral column in the back. So you can get other injuries, organ injuries, that is a complication of the automated mechanical resuscitation. You can get cardiac ruptures, you can get ruptures of the liver, because all those organs are clustered right there, and that machine is pushing those organs in between the pump and the back of the bony spinal column.
Doctor, in your review of the medical records, was there any indication that an automated chest compression machine, a Lucas machine, was used on Mr. O'Keefe?
Yes.
May we can take this down?
Yes.
Two documents that I'd like to show you. First,
yes,
that document, and then after you're finished, familiarize yourself. First one and the second one.
Yes.
Taking the first document that addresses the Lucas machine.
Yes.
How do you recognize that photo or those series of photos and graphs?
These are illustrations I put in my report, and one shows a generic patient with the Lucas machine in place around him to do the chest compressions. Then I have a photograph of the actual apparatus of the Lucas machine itself. Then I show what's recognized as medical complications and injury from that machine. It shows I have an example of a CAT scan of a section through the body horizontally, right where the plunger goes into the chest. And it shows in another patient hemorrhage around the pancreas and around the top of the stomach. Then I have a diagram also taken from our medical literature that shows the direction of force that compresses those organs between the resuscitation paddle and the vertebral body and the backbone.
Doctor, are those photographs and graphs taken from peer-reviewed literature in the medical field that's normally relied on by other medical professionals?
Yes.
Your Honor, I'd move for the admission of that first document.
Right, subject to redaction?
I don't think so. I think that that one is not objected to.
Okay. All right. So would you hand that to
me? Sure, thank you.
Exhibit 227.
Permission to display, Your Honor?
Yes.
Doctor, I know that's a little bit small and far away. We'll enlarge it as you need.
Okay.
It's not an eye test. Can you tell me what we're looking at? Yeah, let's take the top half of the document. What is that to the left, and then what's the machine in the
middle?
Okay,
so what you see on the left is a anonymous patient showing how the Lucas machine is placed onto the patient, where the arms are pulled up and clasped against these rigid mechanical bridges. And then here is the engine which puts the pump, and that's the pump which just goes up and down to to do the chest compressions. And so that's how it's affixed to a patient.
To be clear, doctor, that is not Mr. O'Keefe. That is
No, this is a...
Could be a model.
An unknown person.
Okay. And then what are we looking at in terms of the actual machine to the
yeah,
right?
This shows the actual machine before it's put on a patient. You can see how it encircles the patient, and then there is this circular pump, which is the compressor pump.
If we can look at a picture of the highlighted portion?
That's the circular part that actually is projected down onto the body.
That makes contact with the chest?
Correct, and it has a spring in there that the engine above it gives a certain number of compressions per minute.
And you said on average the compressions per minute would be about what?
They should be around 100.
Okay, if we could go to the bottom half of the page or the graphics on the bottom. What are we looking at in this photograph?
And we're looking at, on the left side, we're looking at a CAT scan, which scans a person who's had some injury from the Lucas compression machine, and it sorts a cross-section. So the arrow here is pointing to the head of the pancreas and the area of the esophagus, and then the machine would compress down onto that. And the important part is that, I don't know if that's working on there, the little thing that looks like a at the very bottom, that's circular and then has a little, like looks like a little steer head, that's the vertebral column, and that's bone. And so the pump is pushing in that area where the arrow is pushing those organs against the bony vertebral column. Excuse me. And that's on an actual patient that had that. Then on the right, it shows the schematic of the blue arrows indicating the force coming down. Then we see the organs, and the red arrows show how the pancreas can get hemorrhage, and also some of the esophagus that goes into the top part of the stomach. And we see that's, I can't really see where that, I think it stopped.
Oh. May I approach you?
Yes.
Oh no, you've got it. Okay.
Maybe a battery issue.
Okay. So, and then the we see at the bottom with those three little things projecting from it. That is the vertebral body, which is made up of bone. So you can see how the chest compressions, not only hoping to save the life by keeping the heart blood functioning, can also cause some injuries and damage, not life threatening usually, to the other organs there.
We can take that down.
There's more live courtroom coverage coming up. Press subscribe now so you don't miss a second from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.